So here I wanted to pull together three different sources about this notion of nationalism, and I hope by the end of doing so, I will have distinguished a few types of nationalism and maybe even said something about which ones seem desirable and which ones seem undesirable and why. Of course, that involves value judgments on my part, but I basically agree with Uchulan, and I see in Mazzini something sort of proto-fascist, and I see in Jones something laudable but perhaps lacking a positive model of an alternative form of social political organization. Anyway, okay, so in looking at these three sources, we are looking at a very broad historical framework. So Mazzini was an Italian nationalist. This text was written in 1858. This is somebody who was heavily involved in working towards the unification of Italy, which actually happens this late in history. I mean, Italy is an extremely young nation, and it had only been consolidated for something over a half century when it became fascistic under Mussolini. And then we're looking at Leroy Jones, who also eventually takes the name Amiri Baraka, writing in 1962, 1963 about black nationalism. And then we finish with Abdullah Öcalan, who is the ideological leader, the imprisoned ideological leader of the Democratic Confederalist project carried out by the Kurds in northern Syria in the territory known as Rojava, although here the term that he uses to indicate that entire political network is the KCK. Okay, so in doing this, we are looking at a set of problems, some of which continues from our previous consideration of fascism. So we started off the consideration of fascism by noting that there is a very tight relationship between fascism and the nation state. And in that circumstance, we were focusing primarily on the state portion of the nation state and at the fascistic conception of the nation, the uniform population, as formed by the state, that is formed from the top down. Okay, now we need to look at the nation portion, and we need to ask, what is a nation? What is its relationship to the state? Does it have to go together with a state? Does it essentially and always aim to form a state? So the questions involve, what is the relationship of nation state to nation and of nation to nation state? What is a nation? To start with, we could say that a nation is definitely a plurality, probably always has a political nature, and it's got a scale somewhere between like a single locality and the global. Uchulan will say that it's above the tribe in terms of the scale of community. And then we end up with a basic question there from that question of scale. If nation is related to nationalism, which as Jones identifies it, has to do with a group of like or like-minded people pursuing their own interest, then we can ask, what is the correct, the desirable, the optimal, or the natural scale at which group definition, identification, and pursuit of interest ought to occur? Okay, so let's look at Mazzini. Mazzini is usually held up for the writing that he did around this period as one of the primary proponents of nationalism. You have a classical view of what nationalism is, because in this case, in Italy, you have a population which does seem to be unified culturally and linguistically, and which yet remained politically plural, politically ununified. So Mazzini is in favor of the unification of different Italian territories and city-states into one Italian nation, and he even designates the particular territory that he thinks is naturally Italian. Now, Mazzini doesn't sound like a fascist. You know, he sounds much more like some kind of liberal. He wants a federation. You know, he considered himself a Republican. So he does have, you know, definitely more sympathetic attitudes towards the notion that the state is grown out of the population and so on. He didn't think about the state in the aggressive terms, or the nation state in the aggressive terms that Mussolini did. And yet he does seem to agitate for here ideologically, and then worked for practically, the growth of the very nation state that Mussolini would inhabit. He may have envisioned the nation state as somewhat decentered and egalitarian. You know, he says like there shouldn't be classes because that'll divide the community. But nevertheless, he did aim to, and he did take part in producing a centered nation state. And insofar as you have a nation state, that means that you have decision makers at the top and the rest of the population at the bottom. By definition, such an assemblage cannot be egalitarian. Okay, so how does he define nation? First of all, he says a nation is an association in which people cooperate toward a common aim with one accord. So a nation is a political unity based on commonality of purpose or interest, identifying and acting for that purpose or interest. He also identifies nation with country, something neither European Jews nor American blacks nor Middle Eastern Kurds could do. He identifies it with a territory. Remember, Hitler had done that, and he had distinguished the good Germans who had a territory from the bad Jews who didn't have a territory but were like parasites in somebody else's country. And probably this is completely arbitrary, right? If we look at the real history of peoples, we're not going to find, maybe with the exception of the Kurds, we're not going to find very many places where the people who claim a land are the original people of that land. You know, even though the Americans claim this to be our homeland, and they even use that creepy phrase, clearly it is not our homeland. We killed everybody, or we put everybody whose homeland this was into concentration camps. Anyway, this idea, though, that a particular nation, a particular group of people is naturally associated with a particular territory is really important, really powerful historically, and here it is very strongly in Mazzini. And he even says that this relationship to the earth, this having of a country, which is the entire area that will come to be called Italy, that is something God-given. And he even recognizes, and these are things that Uchelan is going to criticize, he recognizes that a nation state must be unified and control a determinate territory, not to mention, of course, the population, in order to do capitalism properly, in order to operate at the scale, in order to guarantee the labor force, in order to guarantee the unified markets, and all that sort of stuff. You have to have a nation state. Okay, further, a nation implies a duty. As with Mussolini and Hitler and American patriots, this duty moves me from I to we. This was the heroic in Hitler and in Mussolini, right? I don't think about myself. In fact, I'm willing to sacrifice myself. Instead, I only think about the nation. This is the we I'm supposed to care about. Each of us is to be understood as an incarnation of the country, which is something greater than we are. We become our highest possible selves by becoming avatars or incarnations of the nation. And then, just as with the fascists, there is, even in Mazzini, though he speaks that Republican and humanitarian language to begin with, there's a dimension of expansion and conquest. So he uses the term humanity, but I don't think he means the word humanity. He probably means Italians, but he even says more broadly, Europeans. You know, his conception of humanity definitely doesn't go beyond Europe, because he says that humanity is involved in some kind of adventure involving the conquest of unknown lands. He's got this whole progress narrative, the conquest of unknown lands through conflict with powerful enemies. So this is a colonial attitude. Humanity means Europe, and the natural adventure of European peoples is the conquest of so-called lesser peoples. So the nation, even on this view, again, is expansionistic. Okay, now let's shift away from this kind of country and nation state variety of nationalism, and let's start talking about antagonistic nationalisms. Here's Leroy Jones. Jones defines a nation as a group of people, probably a group of people who are similar in some way. I mean, he's talking about colonized Africans, and then he's talking about internally colonized black folks in the United States. In both cases, there exists at least the similarity of being treated and dominated in the same way by the same enemy. This is the same kind of stuff that Malcolm X will define very clearly at almost exactly this same point in history. Maybe 1963 is the message to the grassroots, where Malcolm X will say, what you got to do is recognize that everybody in the colonized world, whether that's internal colonization in the global north or outright colonization, imperial colonization, let's say, in the global south, all of those colonized, dominated peoples have a necessary commonality insofar as they have the same enemy. So there are different ways of forming commonality or identifying commonality or likeness, but in this case, it is the undergoing of a similar situation. And maybe Jones also thinks that there is a unity to African culture or African American culture, which makes that group of people a distinct group, which has therefore a distinct interest. Nationalism is a group of people acting in its own interest, or let's say a political unity acting in its own interest. So if we're talking about how this is read in the United States in the 1960s, Jones says, look, it's a bad word. It's as bad as communism, right? But then when it's used in order to affirm the activities of the United States or England or France, these are the big colonial powers, imperial powers, or the global north in general, the West, when it affirms its self-interest, its patriotism is considered good. But if anybody in the colonial world, the colonized world, attempts to affirm its interest, which is naturally at odds with the interest of the colonizer, that group is considered crazy. Okay, so at the global level, the nationalisms that interest Jones are anti-colonial ones. So he references specifically Patrice Lumumba in Congo, a nationalist, a Congolese nationalist assassinated by the CIA. Nationalism at this scale means the self-assertion of previously colonized peoples against their colonizers. They have recognized their situation. They have developed a group consciousness. They have engaged in a dialogue which has produced an understanding of their situation, their interest within that situation. They have identified achievable steps that might advance their interest and improve their situation, and they are on a path taking those steps. That's nationalism in Congo or in Algeria or in Guinea-Bissau. And then at the smaller scale, Jones says black is a country, meaning that black people in the U.S. do or at least should constitute a nation. That is, a group with a shared set of concerns, goals, and thus an interest. So nationalism at this level is the process of organizing in order to identify and then realize that interest. So Jones, like the black power writers, Kwame Ture and Charles Hamilton, shortly afterwards, so he's writing in 62, 63, they would write their book Black Power in 1968. He considers African Americans to be effectively colonized within the U.S., and the dimensions that he gives of this colonization will be echoed in that Black Power book. And their nationalism is therefore a process of movement towards independence and freedom in all the respects in which they were previously colonized. So political independence and freedom, economic, social, spiritual, psychological. Those are all the ways in which black folks in the U.S. are dominated, and that is all the ways in which they need to become independent and free. So the goal is political autonomy, self-determination, what he says, the freedom to make the choice. Okay, so I see Jones as kind of in a middle point between maybe Mazzini and Uchelon. Okay, now let's look over Uchelon. Uchelon is largely going to give us a critique of the typical nation state and therefore a critique of typical nationalism, but then he'll also offer a solution to this problem, which in this reading, although not always, in this reading he calls democratic nation, and therefore he's offering us the possibility of another nationalism. Okay, definition in Uchelon. Again, a nation is a group of people united by a mindset and certain goals, perhaps also by cultural and linguistic similarity, larger in scale than the clan or the tribe. So, okay, a series of criticisms of typical nationalisms. One, the unity at which a Mazzini or a Mussolini aim is large, you know, the nation, the country, is large and abstract. And nobody ever actually encounters it. Therefore, it is a mental phenomenon. Think about that. Have you ever seen the United States? And you might start telling me about your travels across the country, but I didn't ask, have you seen different states or different Shell stations or barbecue joints in different states? I asked if you have seen the United States, the whole thing, all at once. Okay, then you picture a picture from a satellite, but that doesn't include any of the people. The nation is supposedly the people, right? No, you have not seen all of those people, and you never will. And the idea that there is one such people and that they are unified culturally, linguistically, in terms of their interest, definitely, especially since we are such a class society where the interests of the workers and the interests of the owners can't be the same, that ideal of the unified nation is totally mental. It is just an ideal. Okay, criticism number two, most nationalisms mature as what Uchelon calls a power nation, which is one that is ultimately in the service of monopolizations and therefore global capital. So the idea here, which Uchelon got from Emanuel Wallerstein, is that the nation state is one half of the world order. And what it does is it produces capital privilege, the circumstances for the possibility of exploitation and capital accumulation. It unifies a market and distribution systems and so on. It sets up possibilities and tendencies to colonialism and imperialism, and it offers a captive, submissive labor force and set of resources. Nation states, in this sense, always multiply social problems. They don't solve things. They necessarily suppress ethnic minorities, but primarily what they do is, you know, and their racialization and their suppression of minorities is really a part of, and, you know, the first suppression is the suppression of women, is a part of setting up a hierarchical structure that will facilitate wage exploitation, that will facilitate the use of the labor of the majority of the population to produce a surplus that will be controlled by a minority of the population. And this is true whether we're talking about so-called socialist nation states or the ones that are acknowledged capitalist nation states. To Uchelon, they are all capitalist nation states, because even the Syrian socialist regime, if it is controlling things in the borders of Syria, if we have a planned economy and state-owned resources and all that, that looks like a socialist nation. But even that setup is utilized in order to produce a surplus, which the Syrian regime, a state capitalist, can now use to operate on the global capitalist market. All right, criticism three. What happens to citizens in this typical power nation or nation state? They're amputated from power and therefore charged with violence. To me, that makes me think about the United States, right? So separated from power, but so angry. Society so broken into shreds, and yet everyone so armed. The nation state, insofar as it isolates politics at the top, denies it to the bottom. And this destroys true society, which is necessarily, for Uchelon, ethical and political. If we're not engaged in deciding what happens to us with those around us, we don't have society in any real sense. So nationalism would be the noble tendency to insist upon the construction of a real political society. This is the nationalism that Uchelon can support. And a network of real political societies, which are basically for him communes, could be called a democratic nation in the best sense. Okay. Criticism four. In a typical nation state, the nation, again understood as an homogenous, strong, top-down, militaristic, expansionary entity, is deified. Nationalism, in this bad sense, is the religion of the nation state. Reverence for the state as God. We treat the flag as if it were holy. Okay, so now the solution, the democratic nation. Instead of a large and abstract unity, the homeland, the Reich, our great country, as the thing of highest value, the thing at which nationalist action aims, and the determinant of duty, Öcalan and the PKK offer a smaller scale vision. So according to Öcalan, there has always been a democratic, non-state community or network of communities existing under and outside state forms. It's always been there. There's always been some portion of everyday life that was not hierarchical, that was not oriented towards profit, that had to do with the integrity of communities and in which those communities made determinations for themselves. They cared for one another. They respected one another. They recognized mutual interests, and they advanced those interests. It's always existed. Öcalan's project, which is a project that is really being carried out in northern Syria, although the United States, Trump, pulled out American troops from that territory and thus allowed Russia and Syria and Turkey to take it over. So now the Kurdish groups practicing democratic confederalism and democratic autonomy are ringed from all sides by these major state powers. A democratic nation, which is a broad term for this federation, is founded upon democratic autonomy, meaning the actual practice of democratic decision-making at every locality. So the greater the practice of democratic autonomy, which is freedom, then necessarily the lesser the existence of top-down state control being dominated. I think what Öcalan wants and what Jones wanted in this respect and what Kwame Ture wanted are very similar. You want self-determination by the local group, not exploitation of that group. This movement has to be feminist. It has to be even more than feminist. The whole change that Öcalan recommends is a change to a society that is not like the nation state, that is not like state formations at all, but also called civilization from Mesopotamia onward has been rooted in the domination of women. That's the seed. That is the germ. It's the rudimentary figure of hierarchical domination upon which larger structures of hierarchical domination are constructed. So if you want to set up, as he does, as the Kurds are doing, a democratic nation, then you have to back off from the domination of women. And this has to be pushed really far. So one of the things that Öcalan says and that Kurdish activists I know say is you got to kill the man inside yourself. Now, this does not mean kill your capacity for courage, but it means like stop playing male. If you look back at like, you know, Hitler and Mussolini, you'll see this model of masculinity is really central to their ideology, and it's based upon domination. If I am going to feel like a strong man, that means I'm going to dominate women and children. That's where the hierarchy of the society starts. Therefore, in order to move to a free society, men have to stop playing male. We need to take direction from women. We need to regard women differently, not as objects or possibilities of reproduction or some kind of, you know, possibility of romantic fulfillment, not as beautiful. Mostly we have to wait for emancipated women to direct us about how to treat them. And then economic autonomy. Under the democratic nation, there has to be economic autonomy at each one of these localities. Each locality needs to control its own local means of production, its market, its productive activity, its consumption, its trade activity. The opposite, if that's not happening, is economic colonialism and unfreedom. And then this economy should not aim at profit. That's not the point. It's not that profits couldn't be made. It's that maximization of profit cannot be the operative principle. Industry, development, technology, business, they all need to be politicized and controlled politically. And specifically, they need to be selected and advanced only insofar as they serve the purpose of moving towards the goals of an ecological and democratic society. And work needs to be liberated too. So the idea is that if work is chosen by the locality and it's work that will clearly improve the situation of that locality, then that work becomes meaningful. And then lastly, and this is, I mean, these are not just wishes. This is, you know, something that Kurdish people have actually established, and not just Kurdish people, but Kurds and Arabs and Armenians and Syriacs and Turkmens and all these massive cohorts of migrants displaced by the Syrian civil war. Millions of people in the area of Rojava have actually succeeded in establishing a pluralistic society. Remember that the typical nation state is based upon homogenization, right? We got to have the same educational system. We got to typically have the same language, right? Even in the United States, if you're born in the United States, you get papers in the United States, say you have like a Latin last name, Gutierrez. You can't put the accent on that word on official documents in the United States because you're colonized, because this is a English-speaking country. The general educational system operates to make people uniform. We've been through all this, right? But in Rojava, in this Kurdish experiment of democratic confederalism, there are multiple languages, there are multiple religions, and there's a system in place which insists that there should be no project of unifying those things. In fact, those different perspectives, those different cultural traditions, those different religious inclinations are actually rich resources which make it more, not less, possible for good political decision making to happen. And then in any case where you're going to set up a body of people who are going to have some power to do something, you have to equally put men and women and representatives of every one of the local groups, religious groups, ethnic groups, language groups, cultural groups. That's a real society, short-lived so far, under deathly threat, but also really existing. Okay, so as a summary, let's say we have a few varieties of nationalism, and to be honest, I tend to think of them as ranging from like bad to good, which maybe that's a simplification, but it's my simplification. So first of all, we have the problematic one, the nationalism of an existing nation state. This nationalism is militaristic, it's expansionistic, it's related to this thing called patriotism. Either if the nation is created by the state, that's the fascist idea, right? Like a few organizing figures pull together the real body. Or even if it has now come to unify with a state, which might be something that happens, for example, in Algeria, it has become a nation state. And the tendency of the nation state is internally to suppress and exploit for capital, whether it knows it or not, and externally to extend and dominate also for capital. Here the you have nationalism, and nationalism is like a concentration of will and action that gets aimed, but it's aimed explicitly at internal exploitation and external domination. So that nationalism from top to bottom is a problem. Then you've got a second nationalism, which seems to be less of a problem, but sort of ends up back at this first nationalism. This is the nationalism of a colonized people. Here, the concentration of will and action is directed against an oppressing state. So, I mean, I tend to want to support movements like that. But you have to note that, like, say, Algeria or Egypt or Vietnam, they come out from under European control, under a movement of nationalism. They adopt, in these cases at least to begin with, a state socialist nation state form. But even when it's socialist, this form still facilitates internal exploitation, a unified linguistic structure, a unified culture, a dominant racial type, the deriving of surpluses, and all that. So there's an error, it seems like. It looks like the initial nationalism is this determined antagonism to domination and a kind of will to freedom. That seems good, but the final goal ruins the process. Oppressed people maybe have made a mistake in adopting the social political form that was the form of the people who were dominating them. Okay, and then we have a maybe smaller scale version of this. That is the nationalism of an internally colonized people, like black people in the US, or like Kurds in Turkey, Iran, and Syria. This is like the previous nationalism. It's a tendency to coalesce a certain political or even military unity so as to concentrate will and action, so as to push back domination and achieve self-determination. That all seems good. But then there are still problems. If the goal of that movement is ultimately a hierarchical assemblage starring men, like, say, the structure of the Black Panther Party, beautiful antagonistic movement, hierarchical, patriarchal, internal structure. If that's the goal, say, of the Black Nationalist Movement, and it was also of the early Kurdish Nationalist Movement, they both have problems with patriarchy and internal domination. So it seems like some solution needs to be had there, and it seems to me that the Kurdish movement is the one who improve on this. So on that Kurdish nationalism, call it democratic nationalism, if you like, or non-state nationalism, which is maybe the important point. You have a nationalism that is no longer aiming at a nation state. It's aiming at political self-determination, but it understands that self-determination as happening at a local level without a separate government. It seems to me that this is a different type of nationalism, and maybe the most promising one.